Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all struggle with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello, Chris. Thank you for joining me today. Thank you for tuning in. Yes, we do get together every Tuesday to talk about those things that are going on in our life that resonate most deeply at any given time, whether it's our heartaches, our joys, our struggles, our concerns. And we talk about how we can support each other in the best and most helpful ways. And as a therapist for 20 plus years, you know, I've watched shifts in how we as a culture address mental health and the struggles that people have on a regular basis, either with their day-to-day living skills or with addressing trauma or grief or loss, or in dealing with change, sudden change in many ways. And it's been interesting and quite often disheartening to see how we've shifted from a position of trusting each individual's ability to work through issues, life struggles, transitions, to be able to find and count on their own inner resilience to be able to survive and thrive in new and different ways when they've gone through different periods of time in their life. We've given up on the individual's ability to heal in favor of a more Western or medical model of approaching mental health or transition in dealing with symptoms and symptomology. When someone is complaining of a sense of loss or anxiety or fear or depression, we look at those symptoms and treat the symptoms without really recognizing the whole person or the whole story that might be driving those symptoms. And so from this medical model position, we have ended up diagnosing and pathologizing many, many people in ways that has crippled their ability to move forward in their lives. So it's from that perspective that the reluctant therapist was born, and it's why I come to you every Tuesday to talk about those things in our life that most impact us so that we can find a way to support each other, to normalize our story, to normalize those experiences that we all will go through at some time through our human journey, and to realize that grief is not a pathology, that new motherhood is not a pathology, that life loss and physical loss is not a pathology. They are part of the human experience, just as joy and ecstasy and surprise and awe are all part of the human experience, so are these other life losses and changes. And so I always want to address how we can do better at helping people when they are struggling. How can we do better as a profession? How can we do better as a community? How can we do better as a culture in supporting those in our community that are struggling? And how can we better trust ourselves when we're struggling to know that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, that we will find our way through if we trust our own gifts and resilience? And so this week, I've been thinking a lot about how we can view mental health from different perspectives and maybe get a different view of what the human psyche is like, given a different, even cultural idea of what it is to be a human on the planet or what it is to support mental health. And I'm fortunate to have a guest in the studio today who comes to this work, this mental health work, from a different cultural perspective. I have my cousin Carol Dunham here. She is actually a resident of Nepal, of Kathmandu. She's lived there for 30 years. She is a medical anthropologist by training. She's also a Buddhist chaplain who focuses her work on trauma and resiliency. And along with her family, her husband, Thomas Kelly, who's a photographer, she and her sons lead medical expeditions into Mongolia and the Himalayas for National Geographic. So welcome to the studio, Carol.
It's great to be here.
So we did get a chance to visit a while back about what was going on currently at Nepal at the time, and Kathmandu is your country and your community rebuilds after the devastating earthquakes. And today we'll talk a little about that, but I wanted to focus more on your work as a medical anthropologist and mainly in the field of trauma and resiliency and mental health. We're going to do things a little differently today. Instead of taking your phone calls, we're actually going to just have an in-studio conversation so we can really go into depth about the mental health differences between Eastern and Western culture. But you can always be part of this conversation by joining us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or through my website, thereluctanttherapist.com. You can send me an email to Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, and you can always listen to previous shows, our last conversation with Carol, at kcbx.org under the News and Talk tab. So, Carol, let's talk about, just to start, your work and experience. What took you, brought you to Nepal 30 years ago?
It was a personal journey in many ways. Growing up in New Jersey, I just looked around in suburbia and saw what my destiny might be as a sort of maybe possibly a Stepford wife, a woman in an upper elite home. And I just thought maybe there's other ways of interacting. There's other ways of what it could possibly be to be human. And I was very curious about that. And so as an anthropologist, I was very interested in engaged Buddhism. I was interested in how people lived Buddhism, not just the ideas, but how it actually impacted their daily life and daily behavior. And there was a war on in Sri Lanka, and I ended up in the Himalayas, and you could call me a slow researcher, and I've just never left.
So your study abroad program for your junior year at Princeton turned into 30 years of research in Nepal. And I don't know if I said this earlier, but Carol and I are cousins. Our grandmothers were sisters. And so we grew up with very similar experiences and backgrounds. She on the East Coast side of our family and I on the West Coast side of our family, which is interesting how you ended up in the East and I ended up in the West when it came to cultures overall. But because we share this history of childhood and family stories, it's interesting to me that we were very close growing up through college, and then we did find our ways going in different directions. But both of us had our periods of time dealing with anxiety and depression and different mood issues that led us to be curious about why humans are the way they are. And you went into the anthropological piece of it, and I went into the therapeutic. I did communications, then became a therapist. And so I'm curious what it is you discovered about yourself and your health and self-care being in Nepal and the Himalayas. What did you find there that was so different than what you had grown up with in New Jersey?
Well, when I went to Nepal, I was thrust into a Buddhist nunnery to learn the language. And I became very interested I thought I was there for women in development. And I said, wow, there's another kind of women in development, which is internal development. And at that time period, then I met the man that would ultimately become my husband, who asked me to join him in the far northwest Nepal. And it's a very remote region and area. And he said, oh, there are lots of nuns up there. That was his tagline to get me intrigued. And we went up and we ended up spending an entire year there and up through the winter. And we ended up writing a book called The Hidden Himalayas. And it was truly, for me, a deep looking at not only just the suffering of others that was awakened in a very, very, very profound way for me, that I realized that I needed to, seeing these people that were just full of joy, and yet they were the opposite of this suburban world, where actually I saw what I saw was deep internal suffering and no external hardship, whereas theirs was one of external hardship. And at that time period, just because of my own knowledge as well, perhaps slight romanticization as well, was the idea of seeing less what I perceived as psychological trauma or disturbance. And I said, I want some of that. These old cackling ladies with wrinkled crones, but with twinkling with blissful eyes. And I think anyone who's ever been to Nepal has encountered some of that. It's what happens, I think, is that Nepal can be very much romanticized, or either, you have the poverty poster child and, poor child, etc., as one archetype, or you have, the happy and smiling. And actually, of course, the reality, just like all of us, is far more complex. But it awakened for me, as I was trying to work out my own difficulties and issues of suffering, I was very much inspired by the resiliency of mountain women, particularly because of the suffering, particularly within patriarchal structures, etc., really difficult lives. The buoyancy and the spirit was something that very much intrigued me, and I wanted to go deeper to try to understand that.
And so what was it about Buddhist nuns that drew you to them, you know, and how did Buddhist nuns find their way to living in the Himalayas? What was that? What is the search? What are they?
It's interesting because obviously there were the Buddhists, most of the women, a lot of them, it's sort of like going into a boarding school, actually. Mm. I mean, we want to romanticize that search. Yet for some women, it's really their rejection of the householder or what is expected of them within a patriarchal society and culture, and an interest in the old days, the nuns in Tibet, etc., where some, you know, could read and write, were considered literate. It was a very respected position, etc. It's also for the family. It's like, well, if you've got somebody who's praying for you, is considered, you know, good status, etc. But the issue on the deeper level of what is a Buddhist nun, nothing less than the so-called trying to search for enlightenment, which you could say from a West, if you wanted to reduce it to psychology, which is something that Buddhists get very upset about. And that was the movement when Buddhism first came to the U.S. People said, wow, this will be a great psychology tool. And nowadays it's being packaged as, wow, it's great for mindfulness. Well, it is a useful tool, very, very useful tool. And yet Buddhism is much, much more than just that. That's just a beginning or an opening doorway into a very rich world of resource and possible tools that you could say is the use of mental health or is the exploration of consciousness and what it means to be human.
So in your years in Nepal and doing your work as a medical anthropologist, how did you find peace for yourself? What was it about this culture? And I love what you said before, that the contrast between suburban New Jersey and the Himalayas was in New Jersey, there's this profound intrinsic suffering in amidst a culture that has no external suffering that can be seen. There's very high standard of living and comfort, but the internal intrinsic suffering is deep. Whereas in the Himalayas, you talk about the extrinsic suffering of just this life is very challenging and difficult, but that inner capacity for joy. And so what is the difference? We're humans. So why are those from New Jersey or, you know, any Western culture who has a fairly high standard of living, why is the suffering different?
You know, that's a complex question.
That's why I like it.
And there's many ways, layers to that. I'd like to kind of share a little bit of, you could argue, the complexity of the construct of self historically, of where we are by the time we get to 2015 in the U.S., the impact of a consumer society, the impact of even industrialization, of the post-romantic ideas. So I won't go all into the depth.
And we do talk about that here regularly, about the impact of materialism and the disconnect through technology and how we've moved further and further away from our core, our soul. So we do discuss it.
Which is so important, which is sort of the concept of also of some of our ideals of how the values we as a culture that we raise our children of what is most important and what it means, what does success mean in our society and in our culture. So I want to, for 1 minute, if I can, I'd like to take you into for example, some of the villages that have been most impacted by this recent earthquake, to give you some of the different layerings of perception internally so that you can sort of get a sense of the different psychological composition. So in Nepalese communities and villages, traditionally, the concept is amongst many of the Hindus, etc., is that you have an Atman. Atman is like your soul, And then there's also a concept that's called the Kuldyota. And Kuldyota means like your clan deity. So you and I actually share the same Kuldyota, which it means that our ancestors are one. We share the same bone is how they speak of it in the high mountains. Mm. It's not blood. Blood we get from our from the mother, but the bone comes from our male ancestors. Mm. And then there's also something that's called the Yula. And the Yula is like the community deity or a spirit. And so all of these are an aspect of our mental health and our relationship to them. What is our relationship to our own Atman, our own soul? What is our relationship to our Kuldyota, our ancestor deity? What is our relationship to the Yula, our community spirit? Traditionally, often you'll even see small shrines or effigies where they'll say the Yula is located, where they'll go to make offerings. So I'll give you an example. We had one of my foster kids. We had six foster kids before our own. They're now adults. And Dawa, when he first came to study in the States, he started having what would be perceived from the West as mental problems. They weren't sure if it was bipolar. They weren't sure if it was schizophrenia. And he came back home, and even the lamas and the doctors were having a hard time. Some said, oh, it must be the Kuldyota. Oh, it's your grandfather as a ghost spirit who has returned. There were many different they were having a hard time coming to one single diagnosis. I would call this, in a sense, some of the illnesses of dislocation, because Dawa then was moved out from his this high mountain area, this location or place where he came from, and then down into the capital. And then from there all the way to America. So that the spirits of location or land from where he came from, there was a lot of belief that they were calling to him. There was an imbalance in his relationship to space and place in his identity. So what's very important to really, when we look or you understand, you see those old pictures of devastation in Nepal, you see those villages that are completely flattened, and many people question and say, who will stay there? Will they rebuild there, or will they migrate down into the capital? Is this location to place? I just, last night, a nurse told me that she'd just come down from Labrak, which is where the epicenter of the first earthquake was, and she said they're already rebuilding. They have no intention of leaving whatsoever. Now, that can also be, that's their relationship to their Yula, their community spirit. And we're going to see different communities have different links to those, to that. But this is very critical in understanding who you are and your identity. In Nepal, before you could read and write, people would put the stories and their history and their heritage and their culture into the mountains, into the rivers. In fact, you know, all of the mythology of which deities live where and demons that fought where. And so that the landscape is an animate place, which it is, as we know, it's a very volatile place, landslides, etc. But it speaks to them, and it becomes a part of who you are and your identity, the very ridge and the way that it's shaped, the very shape of the river. And so this it's a very profound relationship to the nature, to the elements, to their animals. Right now we're working very hard to prepare for post-earthquake, the necessity to rebuild the animal and the herds. So a sense of well-being or health is not only a sense of a single individual, what I need. It can be your Atman. There's one thing that I want to share is like, in Nepali, they talk about tarsinsa, which means when you're surprised or startled. And there's a lot of tradition, especially like you never startle a little baby or child, because they believe if you do, its spirit will leave the body and roam. And that's still a very strong idea. Now, what's happened is that after this earthquake, for example, people, the minute anything shakes, you know, their nervous systems have been so on alert for so long that people are, you know, they jump like that. And in a sense, the old tradition is a belief in a sense that's called like soul loss. And the oldest in the high mountains. We have in Nepal the profundity of traditions are. We have the traditions from the north that have come down, the traditions from the south that have come up, and they're intermixing and intermingling, which makes for the richness of the layering of what it means and how and impacts wellness and well-being. So when a soul, the oldest text in all texts in Tibet is the one for calling the soul back into the body. And this is a very old traditional thing, and I think we're going to be needing to work a lot on that. You're going to see the response of puja, of prayer, through chanting, etc. These are old rituals or tools, but I think that post-conflict as a way of trying to heal is very, very essential as trying to find that rebalance.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest today is Carol Dunham. She's a medical anthropologist and a Buddhist chaplain. She's been living in Nepal for 30 years, Kathmandu. She also leads expeditions, medical expeditions, with her family into Mongolia and the Himalayas for National Geographic. And we're talking today, the focus is about the mental health piece. I started the show talking about this Western perspective we have on mental health that is very symptom-based, that if someone says, I'm feeling depressed or I'm feeling sad or I'm feeling anxious, we treat those symptoms as if they are the problem. But from an Eastern perspective, there's a different way of looking at what it is to be a human and in touch with our spirit or our soul or our mental health and how we define what is good mental health or when someone is suffering or struggling. And so, Carol, you were talking about this soul loss, and that in our culture, someone would, be considered maybe bipolar or schizophrenic, or they would be considered depressed because they were feeling out of sorts or lost or disoriented. And those are all kind of terms people use when they talk about being depressed, feeling hopeless or displaced. So if I'm hearing you correctly, it sounds like in Nepal, especially when someone lives with deep physical hardships, you can still have a strong sense of internal joy and happiness if you have a strong sense of eternal or internal sense of place. That if you're so connected to your environment and your natural world and your community, that even in the face of lack of food and horrible living conditions, you can have a very strong sense of mental health. So if someone starts to slip from that position of strong mental health and they were going to come searching for, your version of a therapist, what would be something that the healer would use to help them reintegrate and be relieved of those symptoms?
Well, again, what I think is if we're I will jump from what we call the emic and the edic perspective, from inside the culture's way of viewing it and how we can view it from outside. When you look at it from outside, calling the soul from afar, what is it? It's community healing. It's not the way we have it where a therapist is alone in a room with a person, but actually it is with the entire community witnessing. The entire community is vested in the well-being of that person.
So if one person is struggling,
if a shaman, for example, if a shaman then is going to conduct a ceremony because there is out of balance, it will happen with a large group of people. It's not done as something private or hidden away. There is witnesses bearing witness to it because actually we're connected, and that concept of connection, which is so important. I wanted to share something else that's a kind of interesting other way of understanding or looking at mental health from a traditional perspective. In the high mountains in Nepal, there's a medical tradition. It's called Soa Rigpa. Some people will say Tibetan medicine. It really means the art or science of healing. And it has a lot to do with balance, just as in Ayurveda has to do with balance of the elements, etc. And the belief is that I had a real lot of fun reading to traditional Amchis, those are the traditional doctors, the DSVM manuals. Mm-hmm. So that is the psychiatric, our American concepts of what we understand of, the definitions of what is bipolar, what is schizophrenia, what is depression, what is anxiety. So I translated specifically, and I said, what would you think of this, or how would you understand all of this? And I think, first of all, what was most extraordinary was, from their perspectives, as I read them, specifically those, schizophrenia, bipolar, depression, anxiety, all of those are curable. They're not something, you know, as like a label, the diagnosis that gets placed upon you.
It identifies you.
It identifies mm-hmm. you. Their concept of illness is very mobile and fluid. And we all have the potential to be mentally ill, and we all have the potential to be enlightened. So they conceive of it in the body as almost like rivers of wind. They mm-hmm. talk about it as, it's called lung, or wind. And when the winds are out of balance, it unhinges us, almost like the mistral winds within. So, you know, as the hurricane or the tornadoes outside blow outside, those can blow in the inner geography or terrain of our being. And that is really what what's one aspect of mental illness. And so how do we calm the winds down, how do we bring them down, is really how what they see is what are the methods. Like right now, post-earthquake, people will say that the people's lung is very high. So how do we ground them? Literally, they use the word ground. So after an earthquake, we've become literally ungrounded. Mm-hmm. So traditionally, they'll talk about food. Food is medicine is a very strong idea in the Himalayas. So we need to eat warm and grounded foods, for example. We need to be around sweet and pleasing people. This is what the traditional texts would say, soft words. We need to have habit. You know, a lot of people will, their sleep patterns get out of whack with anxiety and especially PTSD, etc. And so trying to regulate our sleeping patterns, our diet and our eating habits, not doing excessive activity, giving time to ourselves, being quiet, being out in nature. It sounds like grandma's obvious, you know, you're like, there's nothing, I'm not learning anything. What's something magical or mystical? That it's that simple. But the idea of also using breath is utilized, but you have to be very careful when you use something they call, in the Sanskrit is pranayama. Many of you may be familiar who do yoga, the breathing exercises. But when someone's already in a place of PTSD or their sympathetic system is highly aroused, these would not be recommended. More gentle breathing to calm the breathing down are old traditional methods traditionally used.
Well, that's what's so interesting is we talk about, you know, the technology and brain science and all of the great wisdom that we're gaining because of, you know, science and being able to measure and do research. But it sounds like that even all of the research we do continues to just support ancient wisdom, right? No matter how much we learn about the brain, it keeps going back to. And so now that we know all of this about the brain, let us go back to learning to breathe with calmness, learning to surround ourselves with good food and sleep. That there is no rocket science in the science, that the care and tending to mental health is as ancient as the trees and the earth. So how did we get so far away from that in Western culture? And how do we find our way back from your perspective?
That's calling the soul back.
But can we hear the soul being out, you know, detached in the pace of life we live?
So I think one aspect that we can consider, and I think this is something very, very important. I think many people that are interested in, for example, Asian spiritual religious traditions imagine, you know, the archetype of the yogi all by himself in the cave. Well, there's truth to that. There are people that do that. Those are practices and are dark retreat and darkness, etc. But they also forget the community aspect of healing. Those are practices that are considered to be for people that are sort of like the Olympic runners, so to speak, who have worked very much with their minds. But for often the common folk in the high Himalayas, there's a lot of community healing. It's not an individual process, the process of healing. We heal together, and we heal with our communities, and we heal our relationships. That's, I think, a lot of what many of us who live in Nepal are hoping that out of the political uncertainties of the conflict that we had beforehand, there were a lot of deaths where Nepalis were fighting and killing each other, that out of the earthquake where we're seeing some extraordinarily beautiful reaching out and people helping each other across ethnic lines, that perhaps the healing, a larger healing for Nepal that could happen will be more of a communal healing rather than divisive.
This is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You're listening to Public Radio KCBX. I am joined today in the studio by Carol Dunham. She has lived in Nepal, Kathmandu, particularly for 30 years and is very well-versed in the world of mental health and well-being. So today we're talking about how we can bring a bit of the Eastern wisdom into our Western mindset about what it is to be whole. And we'll be back to continue this conversation. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Thank you for joining us today for A Conversation. We're talking about the Eastern and Western perspectives of mental health, and we are doing things a little different today. We're not taking phone calls. We're doing an in-studio conversation, but I do encourage you to get in touch through email or Facebook or on the website if there's something you'd like to contribute to the conversation or more you'd like to know. We always appreciate hearing from you. And my guest today is Carol Dunham, and so we started off talking about, the two different versions of pain and suffering, and that in the culture you've been living in for the last 30 years, there's a great deal of external suffering, especially in the wake of the earthquakes and even the last 30 years of disruption and unrest in the community. And yet you're surrounded by people who are intrinsically joyful, who have a capacity to be resilient and to appreciate beauty that's around them in a way that we don't see in Western culture, where we're surrounded by affluence. Even those who struggle with some basic comforts, we still don't struggle in a profound way that you would see in a place like Nepal. And yet intrinsically, internally, we suffer greater in the West than any other cultures in the world. We have higher rates of anxiety and depression and alienation and loneliness and suicide than any other cultures in the world. And I always grapple with this. How can we be so far ahead in the external and so withering in the internal? And so I keep putting my hands up and down this balance. How can we here in the West utilize some of the skills you've been talking about joining the soul back in our Western world for those who care for someone who's struggling with anxiety or struggling with depression outside of that medical model? How can we as families help those we love?
Well, I'd like to first share a little something which I found really profound. You asked, how can we be so rich? How can we be so rich and wealthy and so accomplished in one hand, and what's going on internally? A perspective could be that in all of that activity and all that doing, we're so great at that. It's our strength. And we shouldn't denigrate what is our strength, but it perhaps has a cost. And with all of that external, there's not a lot of not doing time in our culture. some people would joke that in Nepal, when you go, it's because we're there are more on agricultural time in the rural areas. This is huge changes with migration, labor moving out, etc. But really living agrarian lifestyle as well as with animals and herding, is there's a lot of waiting time that people don't realize. And so there's a lot of not doing time and that just being time. And so I think that how do we integrate where we're not just constantly distracted, where we're not constantly on our machines now? We've created new tools for that. Can we just be and be content? And are we allowed to be that? Is something very, very, very important for us to look at. That said, I would like to just share two different aspects on some other sides, but to really understand, I think for us, what we can really learn is how to be, and to that it's okay to be without any concept that we are only doing. We're human beings, not just human doings. I work in the Bir Hospital Burn Unit in Nepal with a wonderful woman named Wendy Marston and some extraordinary Padma Gimiri and Manakshi Rana and some other incredible counselors. There, I see suffering like you can't imagine, and this is suffering where these are women, many of them who have tried to commit suicide by immolating themselves, as well as their others have tried, and the family members have tried to light them on fire. So I would like to say that there's, you know, also extraordinary suffering. I also have worked with trafficked women, for example. The suffering of Nepal's women is something that cannot be sort of swept under the rug with sweet, happy pictures. The reality is that even after this earthquake, women and children are extremely vulnerable for trafficking right now. They're very worried because they're, you know, people under tents already. People have been going out. So there is a lot of actual modern-day concepts of suffering, some of it that come from cultural conceptions of who and what a woman is, for example. A woman's suffering, we call them the dukkha narratives. Dukkha means suffering in Nepali. And almost when you go up in the villages and you get to know women very well, if you go out and you hang out near the water tap, the women will sometimes compete with each other. You think your suffering's bad? Well, let me tell you, I had 8 children and all of them died. And, you know, this earthquake is going to even increase a little bit of what happens when you identify with your suffering and your suffering becomes who and what you are. And you can't conceive of what you are beyond that. So these are some of the huge challenges now of how can we mirror back the rich heritage. So on the one hand, you have treatment of women that from an outside Western perspective is profoundly disturbing from a humanities perspective, as a human rights issue. And at the same time, we have some of the most richest heritage of mother goddess worship, first, second century mother goddess artwork, etc. So there's a huge possibility for revival of a very rich heritage that they can pull from of what it means, even the feminine divine, that hasn't been fully explored. I'd like to share with you, if I could, a little bit about in Mongolia, where I spend my summers. And there, so Mongolia is an interesting case when we try to look at mental health in terms of it was under communist rule for 70 years. And during that time period, in the 1930s, Stalin tried to eliminate all of the shamans, as many of the Buddhist lamas and monks. So tried to strip them of their spiritual heritage completely. It was easier to do with the Buddhists because they were in monasteries. The shamans, some of them could sort of melt into the fabric. Well, the Buryat peoples, for example, have an extraordinary history. Some people will call them the Jews of Central Asia because of a lot of the suffering that they occurred during Genghis Khan's time. They were servants, and then they were given away during a marriage. They escaped because the master was brutal, and they went up into the Siberia, and there the Russians tried to make them into serfs. They escaped from there, went to the other side of Lake Baikal. Then they went back down into Mongolia. They fought against the Red Revolution of the Russians and joined with the white Tsarists. And Stalin didn't forget that. So he would go into every single village and he would ask where the men were. And they were very devout communists. And so the men would go off with the government people. And so people were left cold. Communities were left waiting for the return of their men that never came back. So a huge betrayal on the part of the government that they could never acknowledge, because what was the government? The motherland. It was where they had the most. So now we jump all the way up into 1990. Communism collapses, and guess who comes back? All of the spirits start coming back. The shamans come back. And they're all of the spirits and the ancestors coming, and they're very angry. They're very, very angry. And they're saying, what's the name of your grandfather? And, you know, a guy says, I don't know. I was just a little boy when, you know, he was taken away. I don't even know the name. You need to honor your ancestors. You need to feed your ancestors. They're very, very hungry. And in a sense, which is a metaphor for that profound hunger of not recognizing who they are and their heritage as they move forward. And in a sense, when we even look in ourselves, and here in American culture, we're very proud that we're this young nation of so-called, you could say almost mongrels. We're very rich. We call it a melting pot. Is that really? But who are we is still as relevant a question that the Mongols ask themselves as they look to try to answer and respond to a heritage that they weren't allowed to address for a long time, and is, I think, also an important one for any individual to look at.
So if I'm listening to the stories and I'm kind of getting lost in the history because it's so beautiful, and I keep trying to connect it back, you know, to the work we do, both of us in our cultures, with mental health and well-being and the suffering, you know, that we experience. And here in the Western world, we've put all of our faith into our medical profession and the DSM, as you mentioned, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, to tell us why we suffer, right? Why am I anxious? Why am I depressed? Why do I feel alienated? Why do I feel displaced or disoriented? And hoping that there's a medical reason for it, because what you're talking about is so foreign, I think, to what we've been raised to in our culture, this idea that our spirits or that our ancestors would be kind of coming through to us and saying we're not happy with the way you're living your life, or that you're not honoring your space or your place. That's so foreign to our cultural story, right, about the new and the shiny and the bright, that I think that's a hard sell to Western individuals who are struggling. They don't want to hear that long story because it sounds like a lot of work to get back to our mythology as a people. Who am I? Where am I? I'm displaced from my culture. That means if my great-great-grandfather, you know, came here from Germany, that I somehow have German loss. You know, I think that's a struggle we have with mental health, is we don't want it to be complex. We don't want to think that we're connected or tied to something greater than the immediate.
Well, I think, you know, it is complex. You have to look at the economic aspects that it you know, the pharmaceutical companies. This is the, you know, second largest industry in the world. It's a moneymaker. If you're a doctor, you know, you can buy. If you say you're not feeling well or you're having mental problems, and I can give you an SSRI, you know, pill in 15 minutes, I know that's efficient, effective within a time-honored based. Dealing with the concept of communities, dealing with the concept of, you know, how do I acknowledge, you know, my heritage or dislocation and a sense of place and my connectedness, just the connectedness to my life, mm-hmm. not only to myself internally, but just in the very world that I live in and my closest relations. That is more messy. It's a lot more work.
It's a lot more people. If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest is Carol Dunham. And we're talking about mental health and our cultural disconnect from mental health from an Eastern and Western perspective. And you were talking about even in Nepal, which we would see as rich in cultural and deep spiritual history, that there is still a struggle with mental health and how to help people feel connected to their community and to their soul, because there's always change, either cultural change or political change or economic change. So how do you, as a practitioner, if someone comes to you with this story of suffering that we would diagnose as depression or anxiety, what is something you would say to them as your prescription for health, as opposed to here where we'd say, let's get a prescription for a pill? What would be your prescription?
Well, of course, you know, the beauty of the old traditional ways of healing that are pre-industrial is that it's not a one-size-fit-all. In fact, in some ways, there's parallels between old traditional healing and where our modern medicine is moving into sort of bespoke or genetic medicine, which is very much more specific to exactly what you are. In one way, when I just want to get back to one point, which is for 1 minute, if you think about it, the troublesome ancestors, because what they believe that who's speaking and causing problems and speaking in when people hear voices in their heads, et cetera, can often be troublesome ancestors, even if the voices are saying that they're somebody else or something else. In a sense, metaphorically, the scientists can say, well, yeah, those are bad ancestors. Those are your genes.
Okay.
And, you know, if we're going to look at it from understanding it a scientific perspective of mental illness. And so I think that there's, in terms of your question of how do we actually work with these different ways of healing, right now, what most people don't realize is we are exporting. Like India right now, the number of people on Prozac is huge. And this is a model, and I'm sure that, you know, there's going to be people that are going to be recommending and suggesting that. And there's probably people where that might perhaps be an appropriate method of treatment. I'm not the person to be able to judge on that. But what I can say is quite interesting. If you look even at right now, there are Harvard studies that show there was one Harvard study. They took electroshock, they took yoga, and they took an SSRI. And they said, now, they were relatively comparable. I mean, I want to see that study be repeated. As we know, with science, one of the biggest problems is that how often are they actually being repeated so that we can actually really verify or not using scientific method. But I don't know about you. If I had a choice between electroshock or yoga or taking a pill, you know, that's a personal choice. Maybe some of the listeners would choose electroshock. I can't answer that. I know for myself, I would probably choose the less invasive way. Those are personal choices. What we really don't understand and realize is that even medicine and the way we heal, there's aspects that are culturally constructed. I've been out on medical expeditions with Tibetan nomads up in with Red Cross, way up in nomad country in Tibet. And we had Western doctors and we had Tibetan doctors. And it was fascinating to see, as the nomads themselves would distinguish, they would call actually what's allopathic or Western medicine, they called it gami menla, which means Chinese medicine, right, in Tibetan, because to them it was the foreign medicine. But they had their own concept of what illnesses they felt were better treated by the foreign medicine, and which ones were better treated by traditional medicine. Now, what the Western doctors were finding is there were whole populations where they would point to their ear, they would point to the clavicle near their near their shoulders, they would point towards their stomach, and we would see large groups of people all complaining about things that, from our perspective, are totally different, random symptoms. The constellation of those or cluster of those symptoms, you know, doesn't create an illness. They're all separate. It has nothing to do with each other. And yet, when we look then at the traditional Tibetan medicine, we understand. We say, oh, we know exactly what illness that is, and we even have a pill to treat that. So that I think that we start to understand the very subtleties of it. Traditional Tibetan in terms of working with the mind, it's sort of like the Inuit with ice, where just the number of words alone in the language for concepts of consciousness and being able to talk about states of mind or states of being, due to having, large number of the population sitting in monasteries, going internally, looking very deeply at the mind, they will always say that for them that ultimately the mind is the greatest medicine that we have. And they look at trying to work on that rather than on a reliance on external, but that when you need it, there's a necessity for looking at what's external and help and advice. So this complementary aspect, at least that's what we're going to start to see in Nepal, I think, a lot more of, especially during the relief and rescue right after the emergency. People were very happy for broken bones and big gashes, et cetera, are very happy to see that, even though they do have traditional methods as well for treating that.
So as in all things, we see this need for balance, that we talk about it a lot, that we don't want to go too far on one side of the spectrum of Western medical model and too far on the side of relying just on the ancestors to heal us, that there is this beautiful kind of space of in between of honoring both cultures or both traditions. But I wonder, in our culture of separateness, and you brought that up earlier, you talked about here when someone is struggling, we go to a therapist, we go into a room and we're by ourselves, or we are sent away to some sort of rehab or to an asylum or an institution. We separate those who are struggling or suffering from their support system. But I know there's been a lot of research and work, and especially in India and some places in Europe, where with schizophrenic patients, they're actually sending them home to live within their family unit. Have you had experience with that?
Yes. Again, what is normal or what is okay? I would hazard to say that the South Asia, the Indian subcontinent, and Nepal, the Himalayas includes that, probably has some of the widest acceptance of different kinds of behavior that could potentially be pathologized within our within this society or culture. And in fact, there's a concept of as I think it was Emily Dickinson who said, much madness is divinest sense, much sense divinest madness, that divinity and madness, historically, we think of the old female saints, Teresa. I mean, a lot of people that in what modern times we'd pathologize and say, my gosh, they must have been totally off their bonkers. They're crazy. And there is concepts of looking at religiosity or extreme religiosity as a pathology, whereas actually they turn it around and they say, actually, they're in a very divine state. So the ecstatic or the is seen as in a different place. Now, what's interesting is when they'll traditional healers will also you utilize your madness is the how you become a healer traditionally. It's through the ancestors that are banging on your and causing so much difficulty that if you don't respond to them, you'll go into further madness. But actually, if you start to listen and try to work with them, they become your gift. They become your allies. They're able to help you. And you can help others. And it's like it's a very difficult journey. It's a very challenging journey. I interestingly enough, a year ago, I was visiting my family in New Jersey, my elder parents, and I went out to the mall, and there I met at the candy store was a Mongolian, and so I started talking to him in Mongolian, and sure enough, he is born and raised in East Windsor, New Jersey, but he was an epileptic. And even the ancestor spirits were starting to speak to him. So the family was very embarrassed. They didn't know what to do. And so he went back to Mongolia, and he discovered that he was told by another shaman that he had a 300-year-old ancestor spirit that was very angry and upset. And he said, "This guy's really rough. I'm not sure you can handle him. You're a little guy from America. You don't know how to handle these spirits." And the But he went into trance and was initiated. And he was saying to me, he said, you know, it's really hard to be a shaman in New Jersey. Mm. My ancestor spirit says I have to go out and sacrifice some certain animals. And I explained to him, I can't go and, you know, out and kill the dog or the deer nearby. And he says, I need to have a wolf. And I mean, I live in New Jersey. It's not easy to be a shaman in New Jersey. I have been with Bellevue, where we see a lot of the migrant communities coming in, for example, from Nepal, et cetera. And that disconnect is very profound for them in a lot of those illnesses, which are what we would say, again, are soul illnesses, by not being connected with exactly who we are and what we are. And how do we see that and recognize that, that no pill can solve that?
You've been listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest today is my cousin, Carol Dunham. She also is a resident of Nepal, Kathmandu, a medical anthropologist and Buddhist chaplain. And so as we wrap things up today, you know, and I don't know if there's any easy answers to anything, but I think the takeaway that I'd like to share is this idea that when we talk about mental health and well-being, to look solely from a Western perspective is to really ignore our connection to the greater world around us, that we as individuals, you know, there's an expectation of what is success in our culture that is very, very narrow, and what is appropriate behavior, which is very, very narrow. And it's funny because we don't recognize it quite often because we think we have such freedom in the way we dress or the things we're interested in or the food we want to eat. But when it comes to day-to-day behaviors, we have a very narrow spectrum for what we allow, you know, that we need to be able to speak coherently. We need to be able to operate machinery. We need to be able to show up for our job and sit into a cubicle all day long. And that if we can't do those things, we start to step outside what is considered the norm. And then we start looking for medical symptomatic reasons for our inability to stay within the norm. And I think for me, the takeaway today, Carol, is that in Eastern culture, there is the broader story that people are able to live, that there's a broader definition of mental health and well-being, and that when we are feeling something, our first response is not to pathologize it, but to be curious about what that message of that feeling is. And so for you, your last thought on this topic today, what is the gift you would like to share with Western culture from your experience in the Eastern world?
I think that the most important is that to really understand that you have so much more wisdom and so much more inner resources than you realize. If you slow down, give yourself some time just to be, look deeply within, and to trust that, trust emptiness, trust when you can't see anything, but what do you feel, and look at it without, watch your mind and see beyond the confusion and see what's there.
And maybe trek in Mongolia, right? To find yourself a new perspective, to take yourself away from that day-to-day story in suburban, wherever in the United States, and to see the world from a new angle.
I think a wilderness of any form, but a pilgrimage of getting outside of our daily routines when we feel that we're stuck or stagnant, is a very ancient part of what it means to be human, and there's a lot you can do in pilgrimage time period to reconsider realigning with those elements.
Thank you for being my guest today, Carol Dunham. This has been A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org and participate in today's conversation on our Facebook page, our website, or through an email. I look forward to speaking to you again next week. And until then, thank you for supporting Public Radio, KCBX.
Thank you.